What I conceived of doing this morning, we've been having these energy sessions all week. What I conceived of doing this morning was for us kind of have a workshop on what we can do or what we've found useful. And I have three categories, really, what we can do personally and in our families about the energy crisis, what we can do in institutions, and what we can do as citizens. And I guess I assume that we've come to some conclusions, but maybe we haven't. As I assume that we could start with the proposition that conservation is a good thing, whatever else is required in responding to the energy crisis, conservation is a good thing. Let me just start out with institutions, church, business, and school, and indicate what we did in our little church, University Church, Disciples of Christ in Chicago. We start out in January, we scheduled eight sessions really in the beginning, to deal with energy in the church school program for the adults. That was just part of a series. We had one on death and dying, and one on, can't remember what the others were, but partly because our energy continued to meet. So we just started out to discuss the problems of energy, and various people reported on aspects of the energy issue. And then when we finished our eight sessions, they wanted to go on. We did a ninth. Then they wanted to start over again and really continue. So we just went from January till the Sunday before we left. And over the summer, we've taken assignments, and people are writing papers. And we are attending. That's what I think of it. We just have a few people now, eight or nine, that are left out of about 25 who started out, but now eight or nine are attending to this energy issue. And it follows a pattern that you can see fits in with my philosophy, that we need to find people in our churches that begin to attend to something and are free enough from all kinds of other pressures to, and don't have to attend to everything, so they can attend to that for the people of God, for the Easter people. And so we're writing papers to our church, and we've only written a couple, but we hope to. It may take quite a while. I would think maybe it'd take a couple of years for us before we kind of come to our own conclusions as a small group about what the issues are. And thus far we've agreed, because we've only taken a paper on the finite nature of fossil fuels, and we all agreed that. And then we've taken one on conservation, in which we agree that conservation is, whatever else is needed, conservation makes sense. So that's what we've done. And then out of that grew a church. Two of the persons on our committee took the church in terms of what we could do for conservation church. And they now are going to install some thermostats, because we didn't do anything at night about the heat. We just left the heat on the same. And they're doing a study of what the church can do. We have a food program there, what we can do about recycling, what we can do about all kinds of things. Just went through one after another of the things that they could do to get conservation. I know some of the rest of you probably have experiences with what you've done. I know that Rudy Edmonds in Thousand Oaks invited some of the teachers to come together to talk about energy, and now they have instituted a curriculum in the schools in Thousand Oaks. Came out of Rudy's interest in this whole area, and it seems to me that's one of the most desirable things, that we get young people. You could use energy or almost any subject, I think, to educate about all kinds of things. And I guess I think this is a very crucial issue around which we can organize our thinking about life. So have any of the rest of you any experience?
Since you mentioned curriculum, it sounds like very minor things, but yet they make a point, like science education for children is experiences in heating like water. And for example, if you can develop experiences, and I've done this with students, I've done it with children in classrooms, where you show that once water reaches a certain temperature, you don't need to keep the heat up. In other words, the physical properties of water, that it takes a great deal of heat energy to get water hot. Water has this very high specific heat. So that if you're going to, let's say, put on some hot water for coffee or something like that, there's no point in heating up more water than you plan to use. And, you know, it's very common practice. Somebody fills up the teacup or something with hot water. You have this vast quantity of hot water, and then you pour one or two cups. Now, there's a lot of heat energy that is wasted in heating up the extra water, see? And also, once something is cooking, once you've got it to the point of boiling, it is not going to get any hotter. It will maintain that heat. So turn down the heat. Let it simmer. Now that's just good cooking practice, but I just know a lot of women, for example, men too, you know, who waste an awful lot of heat in that by not being aware of the physical properties of water and its specific heat.
Mm-hmm.
Now that can be taught to children experientially in terms of it takes a long time to make water get hotter, it takes a lot of energy to make the water get hotter, so don't heat up any more water than you're going to use, see? And once it's hot, once it's boiling, if you want it to boil, don't pour any more heat into it. You're just wasting it. What you're doing is evaporating it.
Columbus school system had signs put under every electric light system, a switch, where is this light necessary? And this was the clue to teach all children, and everywhere, whether it was restroom or anywhere, well, there were special signs, and they had helped design, and this was put under everyone. It was amazing how the children became... Well, Mrs. Davis, it's not necessary to have that light on now. There's enough light that's turned off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it began by letting the children know.
And they did the little cars and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
One time I was thinking about paper use, and I came up with this idea. I never carried it out. I don't even know if it worked, but a lot of people will be buying, you know, the new books that are coming out in paperback that deal with issues that they're interested in. You know, Toffler, those types of books. You want to do some reading, okay? And if everybody keeps buying those paperbacks, they want to get to them, and they can't go to the library and share that book. So I was thinking of a way to where you could share the paperbacks instead of everybody buying, you know, the current bestsellers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I you do that, except that you would make a list of the books that you have and what other people have, and maybe just have one list that you could keep adding to. Maybe one person would have to be responsible for that. I don't know.
There's some places in Seattle, restaurants, coffee houses, that do this sort of thing. People
mm-hmm.
bring their paperbacks in, and it's not a library. It's not structured in the sense that you have to check out and check in, but everything is available.
Like the exchange shelf over there. Right?
That's a lot of money on new books, paperbacks.
So far as our personal or family life is concerned, I would think that the one of the key aspects is transportation. If we're thinking about conservation, would be transportation. And the kind of cars we buy or think about buying, and the heating and cooling of our homes, and what kind of transportation we use. It's not a simple problem, of course, to try to travel by public transportation. Our railroad system is deteriorated, and if you creates all kinds of issues. And I don't know how we can move toward a public transportation system that makes sense.
I feel it's a real crime when our family of five goes to church in four cars. And, you know, that's really ridiculous. But with one in the choir and one teaching Sunday school, and, you know, this one wants to hurry up and get to the early service and down to the beach or whatever, it just your own family can just about drive you crazy with this problem when it comes to, like, I don't know how many times I've said, just put enough water in the tea kettle. You go in there, and, you know, and the whole thing is full and boiling all the wasting water besides the energy, however. And it's a really constant problem to change their habits, and I don't know I suppose it comes because we were negligent for many years initially. Who was it?
Dave Larson said, we've had cheap energy, and we've thought it was kind of infinite, and we just haven't thought about it. So we've developed all these patterns.
Well, I think they think I've become cheap in my old age. So I say, you know, I don't want the air conditioner on. For one thing, air conditioning is ridiculous in California. It really is. There are ocean breezes. It's really not that warm that often. You can open up windows in the morning. The houses are well insulated. In fact, when I first lived in California, I mean, when I grew up, the houses didn't even have heating. My grandparents never had a heater in their home. A fireplace was adequate. And that's how they, you know, that's really, you just have to take the chill off and put an extra sweater on. It's not that cold and it's not that hot. And I grew up in that atmosphere, and I don't know why we're at a point now where the thermostat has to be down. It isn't anymore since I've become aware and conscientious. But the kids will complain that I'm, you know, being cheap.
Of course, one thing we could do is make energy so expensive that you really would think about it. That is, we could legislate an energy tax that would...
How expensive would they have to make it when gasoline's doubled in price and the usage went down for maybe a few months?
That's a question of how expensive you'd have to make it.
Then does that unfairly tax the poor?
That really makes a problem for the poor.
It makes a lot of people who aren't become
poor.
And the people in unions and who are more affluent just simply increase their costs to cover the cost of the...
Now, one of the other things, of course, is what California has done, I guess, is this lifeline approach to energy in electrical energy is to give everybody a kind of base supply for a very reasonable rate, and really to tax anything more, so that that the more you use, the more it costs you, and in most states, the more you use, the less it costs you in terms of the rate structure. There's a great push now to change the rate structure. That is, the conservationists think that what you ought to do is to increase the cost as the consumption goes up. So if you add air conditioners and so forth, it really costs you a lot more. But there's a very basic service that's provided for everybody, so that the poorer people have that basic service. And if they want to go to the other things, then they've got to... And I think that is probably a better way than simply to tax energy generally, is to change the rate structure. And I don't know, somebody from California know what's happened there?
It's increased, as I say, that goes into the cost of living. Most jobs include the cost of living. You know, people are just so used to being negligent with energy that they go right on. And any attempt at home, I know, I just have a lot of problems, but I just still keep after it. And think, well, probably we'll move out into a smaller place and because of this. So it's a big waste of space. People grow up and they're gone quite a bit.
The industry seems to argue that the best thing is to let the free market decide on the price, and then it would go up. And I guess I have some problems with just letting the market determine the price because of the effect on the lower levels of income.
There's nothing in any form of energy that is a free market, is there, Al?
Most of the prices are controlled.
Yeah, there's no free market in the energy field.
But industry is arguing for it. They want these...
They want these...
And some people will argue that's the way to handle it.
Will the utilities then release their complete subsidy in that they're a monopoly or a legalized monopoly.
Yeah. And that's a real problem, isn't it? Because of the profit in a monopoly with gas and electricity. With oil, it'd be a little bit different.
Somebody else got that monopoly. Yeah.
Well, it'd be a little different situation because you do have different oil companies as over against one electrical company, one gas company. So you might handle those differently. But I think Paul Ayn
usually argues that the way to do this is to use the market and then find some way to subsidize the poor. In other words, if you try to control things, you get into a mess. And so let the market make the basic adjustments and distribution and price determinations and take into account the inequalities in another way. In other words, don't try to make the market deal with the problem of inequality. Do the problem of inequality with negative income taxes or some other device. And I think these are real issues for us. You know, as to how we are going to deal with short supplies of energy. Because it's just clear that the price of energy is going up. And it will not go down, and it will keep going up. And the question is how we deal with those issues. And I think myself that we ought to use a lot less energy. And the question is how you do it. The Ford report says that you could get by with about 40% of the energy that we would use if we just let things develop by 2000. And another student that I've been reading says that we waste half of our energy. So we could get the same work using half the energy if we did it efficiently. But how do you get this efficiency? How do you get this efficiency? Get it voluntarily? You get it by government fiat some way, by simply requiring cars to go further on a gallon of gasoline? Or do you get it by the market system? See, that's a real issue for us. So I just think we ought not to produce cars, which is a big energy user, a great big energy user. Could save fantastic amounts of energy if we add smaller cars, lighter cars, and with all kinds of other technological devices to get more mileage. But I would think that our passenger cars ought to get 30 miles per gallon. We ought to require it, I think, in terms of my sense of values and of energy and a stewardship over short supplies of oil in the world. Now,
we haven't even mentioned recreational vehicles, which are usually pretty...
You mean snowmobiles and...
Snowmobiles and motorhomes and...
Boats, yeah.
Campers. You're stepping on people's toes because, I mean, they're part of our way of life.
Way of life.
They
do take energy, but I think, Signe, that the great majority of energy is expended by ordinary daily transportation to work. And by commercial transportation. That's where the great majority of our gasoline is spent, you know, is used. So that if we could affect those, I think these others would be negligible, in comparison. Now, some firms have really pushed what they call... I think it's the 3Ms that have buses. They have really subsidized buses for people going to work. And it's worked very well. They have 10 or 12 in a bus, and they buy the buses and provide the administration for it. And it's been very successful.
You mentioned not only buses going to work, but, for example, in San Antonio, they have a symphony bus. Since some of the symphony concerts are downtown, the parking is all hazardous, and a lot of little old ladies don't like to drive cars at night or something like that far. They have buses in the area, and you can drive your car, that people can drive their car that far and ride the bus then, see, to that particular point. And so even in events like that, getting to a symphony, planning there can certainly save some energy, aside from parking hazards.
I don't know if you've heard about our diamond lane on the freeways. You're required to have 3 people in the car to ride in rush hour.
Is that in LA?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we've tried, they've got that set up in Portland as well, and it seems, at least when you drive by and look in the lane next to you, that it's not being enforced. Is it being enforced?
It's being enforced, but the people are just really ridiculously, upset about it. They're just they feel it's an infringement on their rights, and a lot of accidents. We really have a great amount of accidents from people, I guess, trying to get in and out of there. I don't use that freeway. I don't use any freeway in that area. But it's really created a lot of problems. People just very selfishly don't want to change. And I know they're that way too.
It gets awfully frustrating to try to get conservation over to people in a more as a moral issue instead of an economic issue. Everything seems to have an economic basis. In our area of northern Minnesota, it's become the thing to put in a barrel stove in your home, make a wood stove out of a barrel. And everyone is madly buying pickup trucks. Everyone has to have a pickup truck. And a chainsaw to go out in the woods and cut all the wood to bring home. And it's almost a status symbol of who has the largest stack of wood in their backyard to use through the winter. And the pride comes not in how much oil they are not using, but in how much money they're saving by going out and cutting the wood instead of using so much oil.
Well,
like they're
using. That's true. I think that's a really good distinction, because people, when they talk about, you know, now, I think within the last 2 years, totally have gone back to their old gasoline-using habits in cars. And it's, they never talk about it in terms of, we've decided that it's all right for us to be using more gasoline than the rest of the world, for us to be ruining the world supply. They say, we've decided that's the way we want to spend our money. It is an economic issue. That's the problem they see, is how much they'll pay for it. And people justify it. We're willing to pay that price. Instead of viewing it in terms of how much gasoline they're using, it's how much money they're using.
I'm sorry I came late now. Maybe I shouldn't ask this question, but what's wrong with people saying, I'm saving a lot of money? A society which depends upon people's sense of moral obligation to do what is in the public interest is a society moving rapidly toward chaos. Our task as political people is to make sure that what is in the best interest of society is also in the economic interest of individuals. I'm not saying that people shouldn't be moral and be concerned about conservation, but one person's notion of conservation can differ radically from another person's. And people have an infinite capacity for rationalization. There is all sorts of problems. We do not, in any other major area of our life, rely extensively upon people's sense of moral obligation. We try to make sure that it is in their economic interest to do what they ought to do.
Well, it seems like it's an evasion of the issues in a way, especially in the case that she mentioned. It seems like it evades the issue of just burning up forests worth of wood.
So the forests are replaceable, under proper circumstances. It's certainly one of the ways in which it's been suggested that we provide energy in the future is to grow it. Algae or wood, or some way or other. So that we use the sun. I mean, we get the energy from the sun indirectly there. Well, I was attributing things to you a little while ago. In terms of how we're going to get, for example, let's take an issue that's very concrete and very important in terms of transportation, how we're going to get cars that go more miles per gallon, how we're going to change the transportation habits so we can save oil, which is short supply in terms of any stewardship. And I was saying that you would favor the market, that is, that we use the market where possible, and that if that did worked a hardship on lower income groups, we'd find another way of taking that into account other than keeping the prices down and using some legislative policy to get the cars to go further, that you would favor the market to get the cars. And I don't know whether I was reflecting your position, but I thought
that's right. And I think that if you go case by case, the contention of using the market, which means also letting the price rise, that hurts the poor. It turns out to be, in some cases, a bogus issue. It does not, in fact, hurt the poor. You know, people say we've got a scarcity of mink. let's let the price go up. Oh, that would hurt the poor. That's engrossing. But I mean, remember that poor people tend not to drive, if you're talking about automobiles, as much as rich people. Really poor people don't even have cars. And one of the reasons that a lot of very poor people have to have cars is because the use of cars by the middle income and upper income groups has destroyed the public transportation system. So that if you cut down on the use of cars by the richer people, then the public transportation system would develop and the poor people would actually be better off. In cases of things like electricity or oil for heating, or basic utilities, you can provide what they call lifeline rates. In other words, you can simply allow people to buy a certain minimum amount at a low price, but after that, the marginal price. But I mean, it's the marginal rate that determines how much you're going to economize.
I think that's roughly what we were saying, and I don't know whether we want to respond now that we've got the economist here.
But as far as transportation, does it automatically follow that if the prices rose for gasoline, and assuming that those that can't afford higher price gasoline don't have cars, but that if there's more, there might be more of an emphasis put on public transportation, does it necessarily follow? What about what she just said? Is that, you know, if the prices are rising for gasoline and then you determine, well, that's how I'm going to use my money. And so all of those that, you know, the prices are high for gasoline and the people still say, well, sure, you know, that's what I'll spend my money for.
Some
it doesn't
people,
push another system, is what I'm saying.
That, some few people will do that, Sarah, but lots of people won't. And one of the advantages of letting the price go up is that people who don't care very much to drive anyway are the first ones to economize. And that, you know, it reduces sacrifice, the minimum sacrifice principle. Those people who for some weird reason are married to their automobiles, all right, they pay the price.
But would the influence be enough? Would enough people cut back or for whatever reasons to where public transportation in cities?
The price rises high enough. There's some complication. The economists use the phrase elasticity of demand to refer to the relationship between percentage changes in price and percentage changes in the amount that people consume. And so the key question is, what is the price elasticity of the demand? How responsive are people to changes in price? And we didn't have any good information about the elasticity of demand for gasoline. A number of estimates that were made in 1974 about the short run and long run proved to be wildly inaccurate. Most economists were theorizing that in the short run, the responsiveness is low. But in the long run, as people have time to form carpools, buy smaller cars, move closer to work, you know, and Detroit has an opportunity to produce more smaller cars and so on, that the elasticity of demand will be greater, and people will be more responsive to the price change, and we will conserve more gasoline for a given increase in the price. Well, that's no doubt true, but it's been countered by another thing, that apparently people's attitudes toward a high price are highly psychological. In other words, they think, for example, the price of salt, say, jumps from 15 cents to 25 cents. There are people saying, that's ridiculous, and they won't buy salt for a month or two, even though, you know, 10 cents more for a pound, 10 ounces of salt, it's insignificant. People were apparently doing that for a while with gasoline. Then they got accustomed to paying 60 cents a gallon, and now they're drifting back to their old habits. Well, what that reflects is the fact that our incomes are very high. And so we're going to have to really let the price of gasoline go. I would favor, a lot of people favor federal taxes, very high taxes on gasoline, so that the public gets the clear signal that the price of gasoline is high, it's going to remain high, no matter what happens to the OPEC cartel, and it's going to go higher. Of course, the trouble is that presupposes a purpose and intention and some integrity on the part of those federal government officials who set taxes. And that seems to be one of the chief scarcities during the energy crisis, integrity on the part of public officials.
When you get your pressure, though, I'm going to echo Sarah's question again, to develop better public transportation. You have your pressures from your auto industry to keep that thing going, but I just don't see where that arises enough to make a big difference.
The real pressure comes from citizens, not from the automobile industry, time after time. It's the automobile-driving American who... He doesn't like the public transportation system. He interferes with his freedom. He likes to be able to go to work when he wants to, come home when he wants to, not be dependent on schedule. I think it's important we recognize this so that we don't suppose there are a bunch of villains in Detroit who are responsible for this. There's a really good article, though it runs counter to everything that I believe and that I think most of us here believe, by a man named Bruce Briggs, that's his last name, Bruce Briggs, called Mass Transportation and Minority Transportation, in which he argues, and provides a good deal of evidence for it, that America has solved the problem of mass transportation. It is with the automobile. And that there's just a group of elitists who hate the automobile, who are trying to destroy it. And it's worth reading. It was published about a year ago in the Public Interest. And it's a good thing for all of us who are anti-automobile, and I'm as anti-automobile as anybody, to read. And so that we recognize the strength of the opposition. It's the majority of Americans, not the oil industry, that's responsible for it. Knocking public and what I would call mass transportation.
So what are you advocating, Paul, now in order to get, I think we agree that we ought to get more miles per gallon somehow for our gasoline, or we ought to change our transportation habits somehow so that we don't use as much gasoline. What are you advocating in order to bring this about?
It's silly to advocate something that that is impossible. See, I would advocate two things: that we establish security of property rights for the owners of petroleum reserves, so that they don't have an incentive to sell it off too rapidly, which would force the price down. See, if they're not sure that their reserves are going to be confiscated, and that doesn't just mean privately owned reserves; it also means reserves that are owned by governments that aren't sure that they'll be in power for the next five years from now. And then simply take off all government price controls. I think that if we had security of property rights so that there was no incentive to get stuff out of the ground, sell it fast, you know, put the money in a Swiss bank account before somebody else takes you, seizes your wealth, if there were security of property rights and no government controls on the price, I think that the forces in the market would bid the price of petroleum high enough so that people would, I think it would go to about $1.25 a gallon. But what does it mean is that that's what you recommend? There's no way. There's no way that one country can bring that about. So, you know, I move to education, urging people to abandon their infatuation with the automobile, trying to convince people that it's a lot more fun to walk and take the bus. I think there really is a cultural shift that can be effected here in cities, at least, if people begin looking at things differently. You know, if your orientation is on that freedom and power that comes driving when you want to, you're not going to be persuaded by any mere conservationist that you ought to leave your car at home and take the bus. But if you come to look on the bus as a kind of a nice experience every morning, like my son Eric does, he really looks forward to hopping the bus and saying, I'm going down to the restaurant where he works. When I was in there, I'd offered to drive him down. Be nice, huh? He said, no, I liked it. And it is, it's a different kind of...
Our bus, I use a bus to go to the university 3 miles every day, and it's a community. It's a social institution. And you know, every bus is a different social institution. I go at odd hours, so I get on all these, so just different people, and they're talking to each other and kidding each other and living with each other.
If bus drivers who can sing opera arias, seriously.
So what you're saying, Paul, is you see no institutional way, that is social institutional way, to reduce the amount of gasoline that's used in transportation. It has to be more cultural.
I see no institutional way to do it which can be cranked into motion by any lever over which any of us have control. That's the problem. There are institutions that could do it, but nobody has the lever of change.
I'd be curious to know how many people here have ridden public transportation in the last year.
I've tried all kinds.
Church bus, that would have been, I guess. But I meant, of course, in California, it is a problem. You just don't have it.
areas it's just deteriorated so that you don't, you just can't do it if you want to.
Okay.
Unless you want to take a cab or something, which is the same as using your own car.
Or it simply doesn't exist at all.
Right. Well, I think Paul knows. I mean, you get out of Dallas or out of the cities. I mean, there's no way to get around unless you have a car. You know, I can't walk from Seguin to San Antonio. The Greyhound schedules are utterly unrealistic. I mean, even though 3 buses a day, I mean, to get back, there's no way of making connections, you know. So there's much of the outline regions where public transportation is, I mean, automobile is the way of life.
Much of the inline regions, too, Houston and Dallas are bad cities.
Yeah,
of course, some of the figures I've seen would indicate that if you can get 35 miles per gallon on your car, you are competing energy-wise with buses and things. That if you can really get a high mileage, I'm skeptical of all figures, but still, they indicate that the differences are not as great as we sometimes think if you get that kind of mileage. Because the buses take a lot of gasoline.
I would like to know about the diamond lanes in California. I understand it's not working, and I just wondered.
You have to have 3 people in the car when you ride in that special lane, and it will facilitate getting to where you want to go, on theory, in a different manner. And you're not even allowed on the freeway, and you just get 3 people in the car. And people have stuffed dummies in their cars, and large, you know, they'll do anything besides that. And we have a computerized system where you can find out who's going. You send in your name and address, you know, I go to work in such and such a place in such and such a time. And we have free computer service where you can even pick up.
Now, I understand it's making a little congestion on the other lanes because
right,
that one lane
people can't get on the freeway, and this one sits there empty with an accident. I don't use that. So
yep.
I just know what I really.
But over a long period of time, wouldn't that encourage people to
hopefully, but there's so much legislation against their rights. They pay taxes. They have the right to get on that freeway. People are, you know, lawyers are lining up, ready to go to courts to sue over that diamond lane.
People also dump paint on the diamond.
Right.
Dump tax in the diamond lane.
Anything. Yeah. Name it. It's been ridiculous.
How is it in Seattle? The Evergreen Floating Bridge has a third lane, and if you're carpool, you can use it. And do you have any?
I think it, the things I've heard have been good about it. It's a little bit smaller operation. They go past a tollkeeper, so I think some of these ploys wouldn't work. I don't think we're that much better than the people in California, but it's more of a small town, so that, and they have a computerized bit for getting people together.
But they are better in Seattle. I mean, not morally or ultimately better, but Seattle and Los Angeles represent, in a way, the two extremes of American cultural urban attitudes. People in Seattle are accustomed to public transportation. Los Angeles is the home of the cowboy.
Well, I think it's a smaller community, and people are more aware of what of their neighbors and what is happening. Where in Los Angeles, I think you can get lost more easily. You know, you have you can become a faceless person and do what all of your inner urges tell you to do, throw tax on the freeway, this sort of thing. And I don't think it's as possible in a smaller community.
I think the studies that I've read are encouraging to the people who have promoted the diamond lane, that people are now beginning to shift. They've been fighting and hoping to get rid of it, you know, realizing that they're going to hang on to it, and so some of them are now beginning to shift over to carpooling and sort of give up what they aren't going to get rid of.
Another thing Seattle did, and I don't know if you've read about that, but they have large areas of parking under freeways, and they gave to people who had pools, pool it stickers, the right to park in those places. And parking is, this is an economic factor, because parking in downtown Seattle is, you know, terrifically expensive. And these areas are within walking distance of, so you not only get them to park there, but you're walking too. And that worked very well.
This suggests that, contrary to what Paul was indicating, or somewhat contrary, that it is possible to get legislation that is to use public policy to get some shifts. You were suggesting, I think, it's very difficult to get adequate public policy given the character of American political life.
Well, I was just being pessimistic.
Yeah.
One thing I would like to see, Anna, is the amount of energy that's consumed by any product, especially say electrical product, I'd like that to be on the label. Because I understand it's quite a, say you have to buy a toaster for someone who's getting married. I have a toaster, but I would like to know when I'm buying an appliance that I would be buying one that would use the least amount of energy. And I understand the things I read that the difference between a Sunbeam and a Sears and different things, there is quite a bit of difference. And I suppose that would just mean writing to the legislature and asking.
Does Consumer's Guide get?
I think Consumer's Guide does. But, you know, you read that, and then 3 months later you're out and you have to buy a wedding present. I mean, oh, what did Consumer say? And, you know, we have calorie count and everything. It's really come a long way. I think that's a really important item to have on.
Of course, we a lot of times don't think about the energy that goes into making a lot of the products. I mean, so if you buy something that uses less energy, that's could be countered on the other hand sometimes by whatever energy went into making it.
You mean if I bought a Sears toaster?
No, I don't know what goes into making toasters, period.
Oh, yeah, I would assume it'd be a similar amount of energy.
Maybe we should get rid of toasters. I don't know. Because they're energy intensive in the making.
Well, they introduce certain motors that will be applicable to several appliances. I think maybe that's the kind of thing. In other words, if you're going to use them anyway, is there some way that you can cut down on having the energy used in the section of it?
There are three areas where, if we're talking about public policy, and about areas for real conservation, three areas, at least in my reading, where you can get that: transportation, heating and cooling, and the industrial technology. And we haven't talked at all about heating and cooling here. I don't know how many own homes, and for how many it's practical, really, to think about major efforts to deal with heating and cooling. And there's insulation, and Dave Larson was saying that he is going to build a new home, and he was trying to figure out a way of introducing solar, and the engineers evidently told him it wasn't practical. All the literature I've read indicates that solar is practical. It's economical to introduce into a new home.
Where, though?
You mean in Seattle? It wouldn't be. Yeah. So it's a question of the country, you know, part of the country.
Seattle,
at least. Yeah. Seattle, Portland. Yeah. Or there has to be some kind of subsidy to help people who are doing this. Son and their house has remodeled the home. Very seriously considered solar for the section that they needed adding on to the home. And it was so, you know, the architect said, forget it, you know, in terms of the initial cost at this stage. Now, it's a long way, but you've got to have the capital to be able to invest in that. If you don't have the capital, you know, invest in solar if you want it.
Yeah, those technical problems, I really am not.
I mean, because they really very seriously investigated. They vows it makes sense. You have enough sunshine.
Somebody else was saying
that.
That $70,000 home, you needed $15,000 extra for solar installation. But certainly insulation, at least everything I've read indicates that you can insulate a home and it's economic.
But now, see, this would be policy. In other words, if somebody wants to put in solar energy, could there be some kind of a loan, see, from someone, a long-range kind of loan to make it possible for more people to be able to afford solar? See, without that kind of help, only the people who are rather wealthy are going to experiment with solar. Your middle-class people, I mean middle-economic people, aren't going to have the initial capital for that.
But if the I think the trick right now is to, if the government wants to provide some subsidies, it should provide
subsidies.
It should provide subsidies to perfecting the technology, not subsidies to put it in once it's perfected. If it gets perfected, and the problem now is nobody's really quite sure, and so banks won't make loans on it.
Mm-hmm.
But if solar is really a conservation technique, then, though it would cost more initially on the house, the discounted value of future fuel savings should make it worthwhile, and the bank will simply loan more to the house and more value.
Were there, do you have any suggestions on how to make the education effective? You said that you thought the only real means was through education, and it seems to me that people are pretty aware. And even here in Holden, very few people showed up here, and how many of us can use any of the means that are available to conserve, recycling or using scratch paper when we've got it, you know, just trivial things, turning out lights, walking, bicycling. It's not working. Education doesn't seem to be working.
I think we're educating, we're aiming at the wrong thing, but...
What should we aim at? What should we aim at?
What do you mean?
I think that most of the education has been nagging. I've almost gotten to the point where I see somebody with an ecology button, I duck. I think that we have to, rather than tell people naughty, naughty, we've got to work toward the development of the demonstration of different lifestyles, energy conserving lifestyle, so the person says, hey, that's neat, and he does it because he wants to, not because it's his duty. And that's education. People do need information, but actually there's more information on how to conserve available than most of us use. The scarcity of information. It's really a scarcity of wanting to. Of course, there are also scarcities of technologies. And sometimes the wanting to is, you want to, well, for example, you know, you live in Dallas and you really want to take public transportation, but if I had taken the bus from my home to my work, it would take me 2 hours every day, one way, because I had to go all the way downtown, the bus don't hurry up, and then all the way back up. There was no cross now, but I mean, that's absurd. But very often, you're doing what you'd like to do is dependent upon other people doing it too. That's, again, why I come back to lifestyles. I think that one of the reasons that Seattle does so well in some of these things is because Seattle has named every little section of its city. And people identify with Wallingford, Capitol Hill, Queen Anne, and all of those, and more readily begin pulling together on something. I'm very optimistic about what is moving to Seattle.
There are split down from the larger Seattle area.
Yeah, uh-huh. And the possibility, when I contrast it with Dallas, which is next to Los Angeles, the other cowboy city, I just see extraordinary possibilities for education. But you see, you got to begin. Well, how would you educate people in Los Angeles? You begin by naming each part of Los Angeles. That's weird. How would you do that? And Long Beach, Santa Monica is good. All those names have to go.
Can you change the names or change the attitude?
Well, you've got to develop neighborhoods, communities. I think that most of the conservation things, look, another example, we mess around with solar, but there are ways to use solar energy right now without any kind of fancy technology. You're using solar energy really when you put two houses side by side instead of out on the prairie where the wind doesn't blow. We set the houses, surround them by air, so that each house gets cooled in the winter and heated up in the summer, and then we have to counter that. Well, but the problem is, I don't want to live right next to him, you know. And why not? Because the way the lifestyle we've developed is I need elbow room. I got to have my own barbecue gear. We're not used to doing things together. But yet we all know that it's a heck of a lot of fun to have supper with a bunch of other people. And where is the evidence that we're developing the new housing developments? Houses are being pushed together so that people can do things together, share recreation room, TV room, and dining space, and also conserve energy heat, fuel by being clustered instead of
You could think of houses in a spoke, couldn't you, with a central room where people shared things and each had its private space that had an outside.
I have talked to developers precisely about this, and my wife once drew up a little plan. And this was about 6-7 years ago. Every American wants his dream house. You know? All I say, well, that's a function of the little lifestyle that you've been accustomed to, the possibilities that you've seen and not seen.
Of course, another project like that is to
develop new cities, which London has done some of this, where they're limited 100,000 or so, and where the services are within that space in terms of walking. You have all the services within that space, and I think we've developed everything. Our whole functional arrangement of our cities is in terms of free, practically free transportation, that is free energy in the sense of the cost of transportation. So that your services, you can't go to a store without driving. All your services require driving. In some communities, there just are no services. I know a little community outside of Chicago where there are 6,000 people and there are no services. They simply have to drive to neighboring towns to get any services whatsoever. It's the way the whole, it's the development projects. Use of land use, I think, really land use. I don't know how you get land use different. But I really think we need a different conception of land use.
You take a drive through many small towns in our country too, and you see building after building vacated because they just couldn't make it. So everyone from all the small towns around an area have to drive to the bigger town to do all their shopping, all their exchange.
And of course, when we shop, we kind of like to go into one of those big shopping centers where you can, there's a sense in which you like it because you've got all kinds of opportunities.
But there are less and less opportunities to walk to the neighborhood store.
I just have one further thought here, and I don't know whether this is useful to you or not, but I have here the results of a study of energy intensity with regard to what you purchase. This fellow at the University of Illinois has developed theory and tried to give us the evidence that if you save money in buying a car and don't spend it for gasoline, you might spend it for something which, while it wouldn't be quite so energy intensive, would really be quite energy intensive. So that there's no simple way to cut down on energy use unless you consider your expenditures. That the indirect energy that's used to produce any project, anything you buy, has to be taken into account. And so he's listed it here. And so I notice here religious and welfare activity per dollar is listed as 27,800 BTUs, and with a labor intensity of 8.8, whereas electricity uses 502,500 BTUs per dollar with a labor intensity of 4.4. So he's both dealt with the labor intensity of any expenditure, your contribution to jobs, actually, I take it. No, not an economist. And also your pull on the energy resources. And telephone and telegraph. This is an encouragement if you use telegraph. It's way down at the bottom. If you use telephone and telegraph, it's 19,000 BTUs per dollar, and the labor intensity is 5.9. Now, women's and children's clothing is 33,000 BTUs per dollar, and the labor is 10. But it's
men's clothing different?
Beg pardon?
Are men's clothing somewhat different?
Yeah, men's and boys' clothing, for some reason or another, are a little bit lower in both categories, but not enough to make any real difference. But kitchen and household appliances, 58,000. And then you've got gasoline and oil, 480,000. Electricity, 502,000. And auto ownership, I don't know what that means. I won't give it. Cleaning preparation, 78,000. Kitchen and household, 58. Private investment, he puts down as 45,000. Furniture, 36,000. Tobacco products, 19,000. Encourage you to use tobacco if you got money to spend. But his point is, and I think it's valid, that if you save the money and put it in a bank, the question is what that bank loans the money for in terms of your money going to conserve energy, that it might well go for things that use a lot of energy. It might go to for people to buy gas guzzlers.
Even if you donate the money to the church, though, you never know what the preacher's going to do with it. So the I really think now that drives home very effectively the point that unless you put high price tags on the resources that you're trying to conserve, goodwill ain't enough. You just don't know. In the absence of prices that reflect scarcity, you don't know what the good thing is.
Yeah. That is the only way you're going to control the use of energy is to make people think twice before they use anything that's energy intensive.
It seems you've just frustrated the whole thing, because you've just said that the only way for it to succeed is to make energy really expensive. And before that you said, but there's no way we can affect legislation. The only way is by lifestyle.
Well, I was being pessimistic. There are ways we can fix it. I'm just disturbed by it. When the federal government moves, it tends to behave perversely. And
that's Paul's position. Now you've got to understand, I'm more optimistic about government than Paul is. I mean, we actually have legislation now which is going to require that the average mile that cars produced by Detroit manufacturers, the average miles per gallon will be 17. They'll have some higher and some lower. And they've put that on, and some of the congressmen certainly want to get to higher requirements. And I don't know what historical events will take place. In some ways, what we need is a new oil crisis, so that we might drive home the necessity of conservation. And so you're buying 40% of our oil from foreign countries right now, 41%. And if we had some crisis, that it might permit us to do some things. And I don't believe in crises for the sake of crises, but nevertheless, some things might happen. Well, let's call this to an official end.